This is the North Sound Energy Week podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Energy Week podcast. I'm Fiona Winchester. A week which has seen the publication of the long-awaited air accident report into the Super Puma disaster. North Sound got exclusive reaction from Scotland's Transport Minister, along with Oil and Gas UK, offshore union leaders and the local aviation community. Also through the week, a crucial decision on the future of Aberdeen's Coast Guard Station was made in the Commons, and plans for one of the world's biggest ever offshore wind farms went before the North East public. More than 2.5 years after the North Sea helicopter tragedy, investigators published their report into the crash this week. 16 men were killed when their Super Puma crashed off the Aberdeenshire coast on April 1st, 2009. The AAIB report confirmed it was caused by a catastrophic gearbox failure. The gearbox had been due to be changed a week before the crash, after engineers at Bond found a particle in the unit. But after talks with makers Eurocopter, the problem was apparently misdiagnosed and the aircraft was allowed to fly, leading to the tragedy that then unfolded. Aviation writer Jim Ferguson gave us his take on the findings of the report.
Well, basically, it confirms there was a catastrophic mechanical failure within the gearbox, and the aircraft obviously broke up in the air. The rotor head came off and the fuselage came down into the sea. And as I say, there's nothing really new in it that was going around the aviation community, but it does confirm there was a catastrophic mechanical failure within the box, and it was effectively not really predictable.
OK, now we did have, there are reports that they had, the operators had been planning to replace this gearbox just a week before the unit failed.
That's correct, and as far as I can make out, because it's 209 pages, very technical pages, probably the most technical AAIB report we've ever seen in the North Sea. Basically, yes, this was being planned, but that was being done normally, as far as I can make out, because when you're, the time of a gearbox is up, or any part of a helicopter is up, then you replace it. Gearbox changes, there's nothing sinister in them, because you change items when the book says you change items, not like us folk with our cars and motorbikes, let it go on 100 miles. It's done when it has to be done, otherwise you do all kinds of unpleasant things to the aircraft's paperwork. But there's nothing sinister in this, it's just unfortunate that it happened when it did. If the gearbox had been changed and they'd opened it up and found anything wrong, then the word would have got around the aviation, well, support helicopter community very, very quickly indeed. Everybody would have been told. But this appears to have been purely coincidental, nothing sinister at all. So had it been done any earlier, then the accident couldn't happen. But they were obviously going to do the gearbox change when it was required, and given Bond's reputation for engineering, it was all being done properly. It's coincidental more than anything else. I have come across this before where a part was due to be changed as part of the maintenance schedule. There's been an accident involving that part. I mean, there is absolutely nothing you can really do about it. What we have to make sure is that this tragedy is never, ever repeated. Another problem, of course, was that the magnets that were in the gearbox as well picked up, or appear to have picked up, particles, which would in turn could have prevented or could have allowed the engineers to pick up on this, because unlike your car, the engineers are running, looking at what these things are doing all the time. You can download what's happening in all kinds of bits of the gearbox. It's called HUMS, or helicopter health and usage monitoring systems. Very, very complicated, possibly even advanced of fixed wing aircraft. They will pick up anything if there's an exceedance there. In other words, something a little bit spiking, a little bit higher than it should, the engineers can then get in. And I am aware of other cases where they've gone in, had a look and said, ooh, that's interesting, and it's prevented an accident. So this one has actually seems to have slipped through the cracks by sheer bad luck. It caused, obviously, a huge shock to the offshore support industry. Came little after the ETAP incident, where a helicopter effectively flew it into the sea, and not long after the Cougar tragedy off St John's, Newfoundland, where an S-92 crashed with a mechanical failure, not in the least related, not even the same type. But it came as a terrible shock to the industry, and the fact that this report has taken so long to come out reflects that the worry that the AAIB had, their intent to get to the bottom of it as far as possible. A remarkable salvage operation from about 300 feet of water, which is kind of broke new ground as well. And only now have we had this report. The next thing, of course, will be the fatal accident inquiry. Given that it was mechanical and the AAIB has a record of getting to the bottom of things, they don't start in investigations lightly, and their track record at getting to the bottom of anything, finding out actually what went wrong, why it went wrong, is impeccable. They're very, very good at it. And they've obviously taken one look at this one and said, we can't hurry this. Information was provided, I know, to the industry as a result of their initial investigations, but we've got 209 pages here, very, very technical indeed, and it's going to take a lot of studying.
North Sound Energy Week.
Recommendations were made at the time and have been implemented since. Speaking with me after the publication of the report, Oil and Gas UK Health and Safety Director Robert Patterson said the North Sea is a safer place as a result.
It's been a long-awaited report, obviously coming almost 3 years after the event. So what is the initial reaction seeing these findings there on paper?
Well, I have to say our initial thoughts, as always, turn to the families in these circumstances. You know, there is heartfelt sympathy for the families. A report like this inevitably reopens old wounds. The report itself is a very comprehensive, very technically detailed report, and it's been produced by the Air Accident Investigation Branch, which is recognised to have worldwide expertise in this sort of thing. So it's a very complex report, and it's perhaps inevitable that it asks some difficult what-if questions. But what I can say is that recommendations that were made initially in the immediate aftermath of the tragic accident have been implemented, and they have been implemented for the last 2 years. So we're already in a safer position than we were at that time.
The gearbox question is the one that sticks out the most, you know, that it was due to be looked at and hadn't been yet. Mm-hmm. But I suppose, in a sense, that sort of thing must happen with machinery every day. It's just been a real tragedy that it's had this impact.
As I said before, we can always ask these what-if questions. What we're going to do now is look very closely at the new recommendations that are coming out, and we're going to dedicate ourselves to actually learning from this report, which is long and complex and detailed, as I mentioned, to learn those lessons and monitor the implementation of those recommendations, but certainly dedicate ourselves to ensuring that those recommendations are implemented and that helicopter travel is as safe as it can be.
And as you said, I mean, there have been changes made since then, and people can feel everything is being done and now will continue to be done. What kinds of things have been done in the past and will be done now to just ensure that safety?
Following a recommendation from the AAIB, I know that Eurocopter issued some guidance on identification of chips and metallic particles that might occur in the engine, much more comprehensive than they'd had in the past. So that enables engineers to make a much more focused decision on what might be going wrong in an engine. So that additional monitoring is already there for that. There are additional checks that are being made on gearboxes, additional monitoring that takes place on a frequent intervals at gearboxes to try and make sure that this sort of accident doesn't happen again.
And do you think, having looked at the report, you mentioned the families, Robert, it's so important, I think, as part of their grieving process that they do get answers. Do you think this report gives it to them?
I think this report gives answers. It wasn't a wake-up call to the industry, because we've dedicated huge resources to trying to improve helicopter safety over a considerable period of time, and will fully implement or ensure that these new recommendations are fully implemented.
Transport Minister Keith Brown spoke exclusively with North Sound's political editor Colin Mackay following the publication of the report.
Keith Brown, what do you make of this air accident investigation report?
I think the first thing to say is that we've been discussing today, as this has come to the fore, things like failures of gearboxes, but really 16 people lost their lives very suddenly, and many families are affected by that. So obviously our first thoughts are with the families of those who've been bereaved. But obviously an extremely serious and tragic accident, and it's right that it's been properly investigated, as we believe it has. But it's also right now that the various bodies which have got responsibility in this area take forward those recommendations and see how they can change their practices.
So how important is it to learn the lessons of this and to take them seriously immediately?
Absolutely crucial. People have to have confidence when they make trips in these vehicles, these helicopters, which happens obviously all the time in the North Sea. Huge amount of traffic there. They have to have confidence that they're going to be safe, that the parts of the aircraft are safe, that the way they're flown is safe. And I think it's for that reassurance, and also that we ourselves can know that we're operating in a safe environment, that it's absolutely essential these recommendations are taken forward.
It's not an area that you have specific jurisdiction over, but is it something that you'll be keeping a close eye on?
Yes, obviously the Scottish Government's involved to the extent that the Grampian Police and the Procurator Fiscal Service have been involved. Those are the right agencies to be involved. But they've also passed on, or the recommendations have been passed on to, for example, the European agencies in terms of aircraft safety. So it's right that we have been involved, but it's right now that the other agencies, which have got an obligation to make sure these recommendations are taken forward, do exactly that.
So what would you like to see happen now then?
Well, the recommendations, many of which have already been implemented, of course, have to be implemented in full. We have to make sure that everything that has to be done, in this case, it seems to be down to the fact that the gearbox itself wasn't replaced when perhaps it could have been. That seems to be what's being hinted at in the report. So obviously the recommendations around that, the replacement of parts on these aircraft, is extremely important. But it's quite a number of other recommendations as well, and it's absolutely essential they're taken forward to restore safety and also to ensure that people feel safe when they go about their business, in fact when they go to and from their workplace.
The families of the 16 men who died that day will now work with the Crown Office to decide whether or not a fatal accident inquiry is to follow. I spoke with Jake Malloy from the RMT Union, and he told me they'll support the relatives no matter what decision they come to.
Okay, Jake, so it's been a long time coming, but we do have the report into the Superkina disaster here today. And just really your initial reaction, having had a look at the report.
Well, I'm glad the report's finally here. I think it'll assist the families in bringing about a bit of closure to the whole event. It's been long awaited. Reactions would be that, by and large, we knew most of what was in the report in any case. And immediately after the event, there were several recommendations put in place and acted upon. The further recommendations made in this report will be acted upon. And the industry at large has the Helicopter Safety Steering Group working on further recommendations and improvements to helicopter safety.
And as you mentioned, the families there, you know, it's so important that they have just, if they want them, all the answers and everything in place to why everything happened, and of course for them to see that action being taken.
Yeah, I mean, there's been some debate, discussion already about whether or not there may be a requirement for a fatal accident inquiry. Because of some of the inferences made in the report about what wasn't done or what could have been done or what should have been done. Lots of ifs and buts. The bottom line is that what was done in accordance with the regulation that existed at the time. One could argue that the regulations were not robust enough. The bottom line is that recommendations have been brought about to improve that. So I think the question of fatal accident inquiries and more in-depth analysis should be left to the families. I think the families are sitting down with the Crown Prosecutor just now, the Crown Office just now, and will reach a decision based on that. And I think it's entirely appropriate that's where that decision comes from.
And, you know, for the workers out there that are still taking these flights every day, it's part of their everyday lives, but it will always be in the back of everybody's mind. So they just obviously need to be sure as well that, you know, just every step is being taken to ensure their safety.
Yeah, and at the same time, the reality is we've, in the UK sector at least, we've only had two catastrophic gearbox failures, one in 1986 and this one in 2009. Which speaks volumes about the regulatory regime and the maintenance regime operating in this sector. So they can draw confidence from that. They can draw confidence from the recommendations that were made 2009 and now these recommendations. And I think we can build on that still further. So I'd like to think that if there are still concerns out there, they bring them to us and we try to deal with them. The whole objective here is to engage with the workforce and let them drive the agenda here.
And as you said, any question of, you know, taking this any further and it being going into a fatal accident inquiry is an issue for the families primarily. But for yourself representing all the men that are out there, you know, is it something that you think is necessary, or, you know, is it something that you think needs to be examined further?
As I say, I would take a line from the families. They've gone through a tragic event. It's left huge holes in the respective families. They've now had to endure over 2 years waiting to get answers to questions. If they feel that they want to go through another lengthy process, then so be it. Personally, and I don't think the union, I'm speaking personally, but I don't think the union would want to put the families through that if they didn't feel it was necessary. So if they think it's appropriate, then we would support them in that. Likewise, if they think it's not, then let's draw a line on that and move on.
Local MSP Mark MacDonald welcomed the publication of the report this week with the hope it would give some closure to the families of the victims.
Well, I welcome the report having been published. I think that, you know, it offers an opportunity for families to achieve some form of closure. But it is important now that the matter is considered carefully by the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service and by Grampian Police, who I know are both taking an interest in the findings to ascertain whether there is any need for their involvement. Well, I wouldn't want to preempt any decisions that are going to be taken. I think the most important thing is that we look at the lessons that have to be learned from a result of this report, and we learn them and apply them. Well, I think that there will be lessons that will have to be learned. It's important that the detail of the report is given careful consideration by all parties concerned, and I'll be interested to see what responses they come out with as the days and weeks progress.
You're listening to North Sound Energy Week.
In this week's other news, North Sea Industries received a big blow with the confirmation of cuts to be made at Aberdeen's Coast Guard Station. Shipping Minister Mike Penning stood up in the House of Commons to announce the results of a consultation into UK maritime services. While stations at Shetland and Stornoway were saved in a surprise move, it was announced the Aberdeen station will lose 8 members of staff. PCS union leader Steve Quinn told us the move will have a devastating effect.
It's very saddening. In the original proposal, the station at Aberdeen was due to be enhanced and have a doubling of its staff numbers. In the second proposal, that is not happening, and in fact the station at Aberdeen is going to be downgraded from its present status and lose up to 8 professional Coast Guard positions. More prevalent because due to the offshore nature, Aberdeen Coast Guard has built up a large degree of professionalism working with the offshore oil and gas industry. Now, that local knowledge lies only with the staff at Aberdeen. It's not held anywhere else in the UK. So at best, this local knowledge will be diminished. At worst, it could be lost altogether. Recently, there was a vote of no confidence in the proposals as laid out, and 98% of staff, that's the professional full-time Coast Guard officers, said they had no confidence in the proposals and are concerned that it will lead to loss of life. What we've said all along is that these proposals need to be rigorously tested. We've been asking the MCA now to put some trials on the table so that we can have a look at the proposals, see how they're going to work, and if they do work, then fine, we'll back them. But the opinion at the moment is that they can't work and they won't work, and we're still waiting for details to be shown how they can possibly work. Well, it's all down to money. Initially, in the initial proposals, the other Coast Guard stations in Scotland, namely Stornoway and Shetland, they were going to stay open, but only on a daytime-only basis. We argued that that was completely foolhardy and a folly. The MCA then came back and said, OK, all the other remaining Coast Guard stations will be 24-7. But as a consequence of that, they can't afford to have a second maritime operations centre based in Aberdeen. So I'm afraid it's all just down to cost-cutting. Well, as we understand it, this is the final edition of what's going to happen. The PCS union, we're still fighting this. We haven't agreed to anything yet. We're still opposed to any station closures unless and until it can be shown operationally that it's a sound operational move to close a station, and there will definitely be no detriment to safety of life at sea. We're still fighting for a no compulsory redundancy package for stations that do close. And as I say, the proposals that are laid on the table now, we're fully opposed against them until such time as they can be proved it will be work. So the PCS is still fighting the fight.
In Moray, plans for an offshore wind farm big enough to power 1 million homes were revealed this week. The project could create more than 1,000 new jobs in the northeast. up to 300 turbines would be erected around 14 miles from the shore close to Caithness. The large-scale offshore wind farm has the potential to produce up to 1,500 megawatts of electricity, the same as a conventional power station. Managing Director of Offshore Renewables Dan Finch unveiled the news.
This latest report is an update, really, on the whole consenting and development process that we're going through, which is a two-year process. Because we're nearing the end of that and getting ready to put together the final data for submission of a planning application sometime in Q2 2012, we've undertaken a socio-economic study that looks at the potential impact on the economics for the not only the Moray Firth area, but also Scotland as a whole and the UK. If the project goes ahead. The creation of jobs is really dependent upon whether the industry locally is ready, to be honest. The issue is offshore wind is a relatively new industry in the UK, but the UK is potentially a market leader. If there are the skills available, and if which there undoubtedly are with regards to offshore oil and gas, particularly in the Moray area, and if there are the companies available that have the infrastructure and the initial investment, then we will be able to consider these companies when it comes to actually letting contracts. In construction, we'll be building somewhere in the region of 200 to 350 turbines together with all the other associated plant, which involves structures, etc. A good proportion of these jobs, particularly on the operations and maintenance side, would be permanent jobs locally. Because logistically it makes sense to operate and maintain the wind farms from the local area. But in addition to that, the large-scale construction phase, which will take place between 2015 and 2020, could have significantly larger numbers of jobs, and we've quoted sort of between 400 and 1,400 jobs, during that phase, depending on whether local industry is geared up and ready and there's been the appropriate investment in ports and harbours. The key rider here is the fact that, you know, it's subject to us getting consent for the wind farm and for the wind farm to prove to be financially viable to invest in and for there to be the supply chain available to meet our, you know, the needs in the area at that time, between 2014, 2015, up to 2020. And then, of course, beyond, once we're up and running and we have operating wind farm. The construction process will take place, subject to the consents, between 2015 and 2020. And that will really depend on the size of machines we use, the size of the ultimate size of the wind farms that we build and so on. The actual installed capacity is 1,500 megawatts, and that should produce somewhere in the region of 5.2 terawatt hours, which may not mean very much to the general public, but it's sort of equivalent to or probably in excess of what the hydro schemes presently develop on the West Coast. And what it will do is it provide for in excess of 1 million homes. What we'd really like to do is to invite the public and interested parties along to public exhibitions that we have running. They actually start in Wick on the 23rd and will be running in Helmsdale, Inverness, Fraserburgh, Buckie and Elgin. And these exhibitions will be a chance for you to meet some of our team to discuss concerns or express interests and just let us know really what you think about the potential for offshore wind in the Moray Firth area. This is a great market opportunity. You know, this is not the same as onshore wind. When onshore wind was built in the UK and in Scotland in particular, most of the technology was imported. Here, because the UK is the lead in offshore wind technology and has the largest market, then the UK and Scotland in particular could really benefit from this if we actually get everything organised in time and if we have the right supply chain and that we develop the industry in time to meet the demands if the wind farms are consented and ready to build.
And finally this week, Omega Well Monitoring, a member of International Oilfield Services Company Reservoir Group, announced the launch of their latest product, the Leakator. Patents are pending for the product, which locates leaks and monitors downhole flow. Electronic design engineer Paul Smart explained to me how it worked. If you can just really tell me a little bit about this latest product.
Well, it's a product to detect the depths of leaks in an oil well.
How does it work, Paul?
Well, we have a range of physically distributed sensors which are arranged to be extremely sensitive to local anomalies of either temperature or flow, and that can indicate the presence of a leak, and we know our depth by looking magnetically at the pipe as we go down.
So just how, you know, innovative is this? Are there things out there like this at the moment?
This has a patent applied for because it is innovative. There are tools that perform the same type of function, but using quite different methods. The most common is a noise log, where they simply listen to the bubbles of a leak. It's got some advantages and some disadvantages, but we have a modular system which can get the benefits of merging several types of sensors together.
And it's obviously something that everybody is very wary of all the time, is the possibility of leaks, and especially recently, you know, we had the leak in the North Sea, and there was a lot of concern over that. So anything that can help, you know, everybody know what's going on down there, the better.
Yes, I mean, in general, these are not environmental leaks, but rather leaks that are causing loss of production. So it's much more about efficiency of production and total recovery of the oil. The leaks are between different parts of the well. For example, sometimes the oil flows from one producing zone from the reservoir, and where you'd want it and expect it to go up to the surface, sometimes it can flow back into another zone that should be producing. In other words, it's actually flowing back into the rocks, into the reservoir, and still trapped. So it's not released to the environment, but it's not produced. That particular problem is known as cross flow. So it's not so much for the large leaks to the environment, but much more for the internal workings of the oil well.
And how, obviously you said we're applying for a patent at the moment, so
yes.
What kind of time scale do you think there could be before this could be up and running and being used by crews?
Well, we have a prototype with us now, and we were offered at a recent offshore event from two of the major operators the chance to run a trial in the actual well. So that's our next immediate target. We'd hope to do that before the end of this year. And then in quarter one of next year, we expect to be able to go commercial. We have little doubt about the viability of the tool, but we just want to get some experience before we go commercial. We first revealed the tool at an SPE, a Society of Petroleum Engineers event in Aberdeen, and it generated quite a lot of interest from people who know about this sort of technologies. And it is a new thing on the market, so it did draw a lot of people in, and we had a working prototype there to show people.
And that's the Energy Week podcast. I'm Fiona Winchester.
This is the North Sound Energy Week podcast.